Welcome to Seeking Alpha's Wall Street Breakfast, your daily source of market news and analysis. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
Welcome to Seeking Alpha, Alpha Talks Editors Roundtable. What moved the markets this week? The week ending Friday, April 16, 2021. A very positive week for stocks and for risk assets. We had record highs for the Dow and I believe S&P. The Dow index broke through the 34,000 barrier for the first time, first ever close above 34,000. And a very good week, of course, for Coinbase, which had its IPO, which is apparently, according to who you talk to, maybe not an IPO, strictly speaking, but whatever, they're public now, and that stock did very well on its first day of trading. And more recently now today, on Friday, we have Dogecoin doing very well. I don't know what Dogecoin is. I don't know how to pronounce it. Maybe my colleagues can shed some light on it. Let me introduce them now. In no particular order, Brad Olison, VP of News, Kim Kahn, Senior News Editor, Stephen Alfer, Managing Editor of Breaking News. I am your host and moderator, Nathaniel E. Baker, Senior Editor of Strategic Contributors. Let's kick it off with Kim, as we usually do, to give us the big picture lay of the land and get us caught up on what moved markets this week.
This week was kind of a show me week for economic data. And as much as investors who had bid up the markets to record highs wanted to see some evidence that the U.S. economy is gaining traction, recovering. And I think that those numbers pretty much came through. We had CPI up at its biggest monthly gain since 2012, but it wasn't too much of a pop in inflation to really to spook the market that day. We had retail sales for March up nearly 10%. But I actually think what really got the market going yesterday and has kind of cemented the gains of the week for stocks is jobless claims, which dropped substantially in the initial claims to below 600,000 again. They had been up above 700,000 for a couple of weeks. And also, if you looked at like applications for all benefits and assistance, that includes the pandemic unemployment assistance program, that dropped by 1.2 million. And so that's a sizable drop in the number of people applying for benefits. It's indicating some appetite and for people getting back into the job market. So I think that helped a lot. And the market basically Thursday's gains kind of like have it riding in to look like it's gonna all three major averages will close higher.
Yeah, a very good week. A couple of other things that we didn't even mention. One was earnings season kickoff with positive reports and beats all around. Just about every financial, at least that I saw, beat on EPS and also on revenues, which interestingly didn't really move things all that much. But like you said, we are higher. So then, Brad, take us through the winners and losers.
Right. So as Kim alluded to, obviously a bumper week for economic data, as you mentioned, retail sales, ISM, jobless claims, and the banks were definitely supportive. Some of the results were definitely indicative of a stronger economy. I would like to add, though, that even though we talk about the market broadly being up, there were some, it was more of a defensive week following the shocker from J&J about their shot potentially leading to blood clots. And so I think that had a dampening effect midweek, and you did see some of the risk off shift a little bit, work from home names, the old ones that we used to talk about in this program rather regularly, like Zoom and Fastly and DocuSign, Sword. And even though that J&J shot is only a small percentage of the vaccines, I think what's notable to take away is that in polling post that suspension, people found have a deeper distrust of the vaccines than they did before. And so that could probably explain why the market sold off despite just a small penetration on the vaccine part. And then with that, you saw airlines pull back, Delta, American Air, and cruise lines, Norwegian Cruise Line, RCL, And then some of the other big losers were the week were still the ramifications from the Archegos Capital blow up. You had Discovery was, I think, one of the biggest losers in the S&P, and Viacom as well. That Viacom chart, by the way, is just incredible. I encourage everyone who's listening and watching to look at the 1 year chart, just tripling in a few months and then losing 60% in just a few days. As some of our readers will know, Morgan Stanley disclosed a $900 impact from that Archegos Capital blow up. Credit Suisse, I think, had a $4.7 billion charge. So the ramifications are still looming large from that hedge fund blow up. But I think with the J&J combined with some of the, what we don't talk about often on this program is geopolitical risks, with the exception of our guest last week. Mind you, new sanctions on Russia also probably having a dampening effect just from a defensive positioning standpoint for stocks broadly.
Yeah, although on the J&J news, I can't even remember what day it was, if it was Tuesday or Wednesday, but the market seemed to shrug that off pretty quickly. And J&J shares have almost recovered to where
they weren't impacted at all, right?
I mean, there were little, but not all that much. So it just speaks to maybe how resilient this market is. But also, we did have some better news, like Pfizer came in and said they can deliver these vaccines to make up for J&J's shortfall and stuff, which I'm sure helped. Anyway, on that, Stephen Alfer, over to you. What were you watching this week?
Well, you know, earnings. If it's the start of earnings season, it's going to be bank stocks are generally among the first reporters. And as you pointed out, they all beat, but they generally always all beat unless something really goes bad, like it did in the first quarter last year. So the beats really are not news, and stocks should not necessarily rise on that news, especially when they've had such big rallies going into earnings. So investment banking was gangbusters, as anybody who's been following the news with the IPOs, the SPACs, that's all, you know, big investment banking fees. And also there was the reserve release. If you remember Q1 a year ago, right, they all had to add to reserves massively. And now those reserves the losses aren't as bad as feared. So they're able to release reserves as needed to, you know, kind of crank the earnings up. But importantly, the headwinds are low interest rates. I think pretty sure almost all the, at least the consumer focused banks, all mentioned that, you know, margins aren't improving in that area. And the outlook wasn't great going forward in that area. So that, you know, maybe that was responsible a little bit for some of the less enthusiastic reaction by the market.
Yeah, very interesting. What else? What do you make of the IPO this week or whatever it was, the Coinbase thing? And the rally we saw there.
My biggest take is there's going to be a lot more crypto-related IPOs this year. Seeing the reception and the valuation that Coinbase got, there's going to be other exchanges before year end that are probably going to be public. Kraken. I'm not exactly sure how it's pronounced. Binance. You know, maybe that's more overseas. FTX is another little player overseas. Gemini, which is the Winklevoss company. My guess is they IPO before end. Mike Novogratz is Galaxy Digital. They just hired an ex-Goldman guy as their chairman. So they're probably prepping an IPO. They're not an exchange per se. He's trying to be like a crypto investment bank. So you're going to see, you know, Wall Street always finds a way to, you know, kind of soak up the demand. And there's a lot of demand for that right now.
So you're saying we're going to be seeing a lot of weeks like this in terms of the news flow around cryptos?
Yeah, you know, maybe not in the immediate future, but certainly before year end. Yeah.
All right. I have something to look forward to or not. All right. Let's move on to the segment of the show where we talk about our favorite articles, Seeking Alpha news coverage or other things that we've worked on or seen and covered, perhaps edited. And why don't we start with Kim?
Well, I'm going to bring out a name we haven't heard in a little while, Roaring Kitty, who is the big bull on GameStop on the Wall Street Bets board, and was the he was in front of the House Financial Service Committee being questioned after the squeeze. And today he's his options contracts on GameStop are expiring, and he looks set to rake in at current prices around $7 million on that trade if he sells or lets them expire. He, at the beginning of the year, bought 500 options contracts with a $12 strike price. Stock is now around 155. So he paid about $10,000 for those options. So a nice little haul for him today from sticking with his bullish GameStop theme. And also in GameStop, we had David Einhorn out with his Greenlight Capital first quarter letter, and he was kind of doing his postmortem on the GameStop squeeze of what was learned. And, you know, in between all those pot shots against Elon Musk, there's still some, I think, bitterness over the short position he had on Tesla last year. But he's talking about what he learned and was out to say, saying that really there shouldn't be any kind of restrictions on, you know, discussing whether stock should go up or down, and nobody should be hauled in front of Congress for having a stock pick. Also saying that, you know, hedge funds should be free to lose as much money as possible if they make the wrong stock pick. But and a big thing he was hammering home was, though, he doesn't feel like any kind of regulation has any teeth at all on Wall Street these days, and that, you know, basically anybody, as he put it, involved in any malfeasance can pretty much get away with it.
Yeah, David Einhorn is certainly a smart guy, interesting insights. But if anybody knows about a hedge fund that's lost money for its investors, it is certainly him. I mean, his performance, I mean, last I looked at it, was pretty horrific. Anyway, Brad, over to you. What about your favorite stories?
So, you know, you kind of alluded to it earlier today, earlier in this program, Cole, and it was the Coinbase story for me. I think it was interesting to watch earlier in the week. There's this crypto exchange called FTX in Germany, which had been pricing the expected opening from this direct listing. And I think they estimated that it close to $463 a share. That was well above the $250 reference price that NASDAQ and Goldman put together ahead of Coinbase's actual opening. The price on the day actually rose as high as, I think, $430 or so. But obviously, that story has just captivated the market with opening up 50%, I think, above its reference price when all is said and done, around, you know, 130 or so. So Coinbase, obviously going to be a story for some time, as Steve alluded to. I think what we mentioned last week when I kind of previewed this was Robinhood is about to get into the space and try to double down on some of those trading aspects of crypto. There's not a whole lot of barriers to entry from what I'm gathering, although a lot on the street have come out and initiated on Coinbase and have some rather high hopes. You know, we talked about D.A. Davidson's $440 price target last week, and I think Moffitt Nathanson one upped them with a $600 price target, if I'm not mistaken. So a lot of optimism for this company going forward, especially as the interest in Bitcoin continues to rise. One thing I would note is I would encourage most of our readers to dive into our transcripts at Seeking Alpha. You can see a lot of interesting commentary from some of the banks on where they expect Bitcoin to go and whether they expect to adopt them more broadly in some of their instruments.
Yeah, watch that space, because that's the story I want to talk about. But Stephen, you first. What was your favorite piece of the week?
Yeah, and I'll just add on Coinbase, their fees are incredibly high. It's like trading stocks in 1970, right? I mean, it just, you know, that's going to go to zero over the next whatever. You know, things are very speeded up now. It took 30 years for Wall Street to move from 1970 prices to zero, or 30 or 40 years. It'll probably happen in about 1 or 2 years in crypto. That doesn't mean Coinbase can't be wildly successful, but they're not going to be making it from those massive fees that they're charging for retail traders. My favorite story was, and I think Kim might have written it up, was the exchange between Elon Musk and Cathie Wood of ARK Investments. Elon kind of tweeted out, hey, do you think the market, the S&P 500 is too high relative to GDP? And she came back with a very kind of detailed description of why she doesn't think it's too high in relation to GDP. Basically going back to pre-World War I, late 1800s, early 1900s, she said the major index had a much higher proportion of GDP back then because it was a time of great technological advancement. And she says this is the technological advancement now is wildly greater than what was going on then. So there's really good reasons, mainly digital transformation, for the S&P and to be trading that highs. So it was an interesting conversation, and it just goes to show you the interesting times we live in, where two, you know, for better or worse, giants of their industries kind of having this open, frank discussion for everybody to see there on Twitter. It's great stuff.
Indeed. Well, for me, some of Cathie Wood's comments harken back a little bit to the tech bubble, the 90s tech bubble, when people were saying a lot of the same thing about tech stocks and how they should be valued higher because of their transformative effects and all these other things. Of course, no, those stocks didn't have revenues a lot of them or anything like that. So it was still quite different in fairness.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a bold move to use going back to an agrarian economy as your example of great technological innovation and how it's going to be applicable today.
Yeah, one of those where history may not come back to repeat itself. Who knows? But my favorite story here, and touching on what's been said, Larry Fink, say what you want about him. He is head of the world's biggest asset manager. I believe BlackRock now manages, what did I hear, $9 trillion? Is that right? I believe, according to their latest earnings. But he was on CNBC yesterday, and he's kind of been a little bit bullish on Bitcoin. But what he said yesterday, I thought was very interesting. And he says, with reference to Bitcoin, quote, "We're studying it. We make money on it. But I'm not here to tell you that we're seeing broad-based interest by institutions worldwide." So I thought that was interesting because a lot of what we've been hearing is about this institutional adaptation of Bitcoin and cryptos more generally. But here he is, and he says actually that the ESG conversations are a lot more detailed. There's a lot more interest from institutional clients on that than there is for Bitcoin. So I thought that was very interesting.
And I think those two points kind of run in different directions too, right? With I think one of the main critiques of Bitcoin is the energy usage that's required. Mm-hmm. So I think that's just interesting how those two are running across currents, the ESG plus Bitcoin.
But yeah. All right, well, that wraps up our show for this week. Thank you all for listening or watching, as the case may be. On that, for those of you listening, please do check out the videos. They drop around market close, 4 p.m. Eastern on Friday afternoon. With that, we thank you for watching and look forward to speaking to you again next week.
That concludes today's Wall Street Breakfast. Thank you for listening. For the best investment analysis and news on the web, go to seekingalpha.com. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can sign up for our other podcasts, Behind the Idea, Essay for FAs, Let's Talk ETFs, the Cannabis Investing Podcast, and Marketplace Roundtable on those platforms as well. Have a great day.